Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. So just to first of all give a bit of a trigger warning, this week's episode is to coincide with Baby Loss Awareness Week. Baby Loss Awareness Week is the 9th to the 15th of October, I think every year. And this week I'll be speaking to Sarah Brown about the loss of their daughter. I will give you some more information about her in a second, but I just wanted to say I have done a few episodes on child loss and I just want to be honest with you that it, you know, here at Griefcast, with me at Griefcast, I really want to cover all types of grief. I want everyone to have an episode that will help them. Baby loss is not something I have experienced, and I have spoken to people about it before because I think it's really important that it's covered. I get lots of emails from listeners asking me to cover it. And this interview, I'd very, very recently given birth to my second child, which Sarah actually very kindly, you'll hear references in the interview saying, you know, are you sure you're up for this? And I don't think I was. I don't think I did a good enough job as I have sometimes done maybe in the past or I could have done. And I think that is entirely down to my own fears. And, you know, I speak about this all the time in the podcast. Oh, people think like death is catching and we should talk about it. But you know what? It's really hard to have these conversations, especially when it comes to babies and children. So I just want to say, if you are someone who's experienced baby loss and you feel like I don't do a very good job in this interview, I'm sorry, because I agree with you. I don't think I did the best job possible. And I think that maybe because I haven't experienced it, perhaps it's just really, perhaps I'm not the best person to do those interviews, but I do. The reason I do them is because I do want there to be those episodes in case it's helpful. So that is my apology to you. If you are experiencing baby loss or you have going through it or you've been through it, I just wanted to say sorry and to also let you know that there's this episode. I have also interviewed Luke Conran, who lost a baby in pregnancy. I have a couple of episodes about miscarriages, including Sarah Barron and Garrett Millerick and Mother Pucker, as she is known, Anna Whitehouse. There is also an episode with Jason Green, who lost his daughter when she was 2 years old as well. So, and Zoe Adele, who runs Saying Goodbye, which is an amazing baby loss charity as well. So if you are looking for other episodes, we do have them. This week I'm talking to Sarah Brown. You may be familiar with Sarah for being the wife of former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, but in her own right, she's the chair of global children's charity Their World. Sarah came in to talk to me about her daughter Jennifer, who died just 10 days after she was born. I'm going to ask this because I don't know how you can start a conversation without mentioning it. Like, how has your lockdown been so far? Has it been okay? Or,
well, there's two sides to the lockdown. One is the kind of day-to-day and my life's completely fine. I'm with my family, with my favourite people, and we've all adapted so brilliantly. So you end up connecting in with the outside world. Everyone at the charity, Their World, no one's been furloughed. Everyone moved to working from home.
Oh, that's good.
They've adapted projects, even ones that are, you know, refugee camps on the Greek islands or co-clubs in Africa. All of those have adapted. So that side of it, I've been, you know, overwhelmed by how flexible people have been. And to that extent, lockdown's gone well. But the fact of why we are in lockdown is the tragedy, really. And to think of the suffering that people have gone through is, so it's always set against that.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair and eloquent answer. Because I think for most people, it's the same, isn't it? It's like most people's day to day has, it's just like you're in a lot. But yeah, it hasn't, the majority of people hasn't massively affected, but yeah, I completely agree with you. It's sort of staggering, isn't it?
Well, everything, when you think of somebody, and you know, I'm in a house and I've got a garden, and I think of you know, a family stuck in a tiny flat, you know, that's not fun just to get through the day-to-day of that, you know.
No.
Or young children who just want to go and roar around somewhere.
Yeah, I know. Because I have a friend who lives in Spain, and I know they did complete lockdown. So my friends were in a flat with a three-year-old, not allowed to leave. And every day I kept thinking, as long as they let us out, like as long as I can go to a park, then this is bearable, because the child can run.
Yeah, they were really tough in Spain. My sister-in-law was out there with her husband, and they had to take it in turns to walk the dog, because only one person was allowed walking with the dog.
Whoa. Oh, that's so, yeah, that's what they, when they ease it, my friend said, like, the mum went out, one was allowed out with the three-year-old, then the dad was allowed. They weren't allowed to out together. God. But yeah, I mean, you have to do these things, don't you? It's a difficult time. So Sarah, obviously we're not here to discuss COVID-19, although how can anyone talk about anything else at the moment? Who are we remembering today?
Well, talking to you, I obviously want to remember Jennifer, who was my baby daughter that we lost at a very young age, which is the greatest loss in my life, of course. You know.
And how old was Jennifer?
She was just 10 days old.
Oh, that is so... Oh. I mean, there's no good age, is there, for a baby to leave this world? But when you say a number like that, it just seems so precious and tiny, such a tiny little thing. So what was her full name? Was it? So did she have a middle name?
Well, she was Jennifer Jane, but it was one of those things where you're kind of rushed into everything, including registering names and things. So we'd chosen Jennifer together, and Jane was my middle name, so...
Oh, I didn't even think of that. Of course, you then suddenly have to do all the admin side of it at the moment. So this was your first pregnancy?
It was my first pregnancy, my first child.
Goodness.
Jennifer was born at the very end of 2001, in December, just after Christmas. And Gordon and I had got married the year before. I'd got pregnant. We were really happy about it. We were, by that point, Gordon was Chancellor of the Exchequer, so we were in Downing Street and a bit under the spotlight. And I was looking at changing my work, but still planning to stay working, which I did do. But I'd actually just changed where I was working, went to set up an arts PR firm. It just, none of it was expected. None of, I hadn't experienced it with anyone else. I hadn't really been at that time aware of anything like that happening to anyone else.
It's a terrible shock anyway, but if it comes completely, if you haven't even entered your sphere of this is something that might happen.
No, not really. I mean, you sort of, you know, everything seemed to be going well, but we'd gone in for a sort of late on scan, and suddenly everything went from 0 to 90, and suddenly I had to kind of move quite quickly. And they delivered her a little bit early, and we were all hoping that everything was okay. She was very little, and then as the days evolved, she had to go through a transfer from one hospital to another. So she was moved by ambulance to Edinburgh, which that was one of the hardest moments right in the middle. And then from that moment, it changed gear. At that moment, we knew that over those period of days, we would lose her. And it was about spending the time with her.
So they told you that she wasn't going to be able to survive?
Not at the beginning, but at some point, yeah. We just, in those last few days. So everything had been working very hard to do everything you could. And everyone being, our NHS is extraordinary.
Oh, incredible.
So everyone from, you know, the consultants with their expertise, but through to, you know, the neonatologists, but also the nurses that work there and the carers, they're working in those special care baby units. And I just think the work they do there is so remarkable, because there are lots of happy outcomes, lots of moments where they arrive, everything's really scary and kind of taking off. But what they can do and the care that they can bring, there's many, many happy outcomes. But for us, it wasn't to be. But what was frustrating was also that we didn't really have an explanation, that no one could explain to us quite why it had happened.
Oh, gosh.
And so that set me off on another journey beyond that, to try and think about what we can do to kind of bring greater knowledge to that area. So a lot is good. I'm talking about this 18 years on, looking back. I can see a lot of good has come out of that tragedy for us, but it's a huge, huge loss, and one Gordon and I live with every day.
I think that's the thing, isn't it, with grief, that so much good can come out of a loss. Of course it can. Nothing is ever good, or nothing is ever all good or all bad, you know. That's the way of human life. It's so mixed, but it doesn't stop something being incredibly painful, as obviously it is. So did you manage to, you said you spent those last few days with her?
Yeah, just very, very precious moments. Our family were able to come and visit her. Yeah, and when I look back on it, even now, I'm sure Gordon would say the same. We can remember every single moment. It was so precious. And when you're with a baby where that life is so short, actually every single experience and time, I feel I got to know her really well. I knew her fight. I knew the, you know, the sort of everything she had there. So, yeah, it's many years later, but it's still very painful, but combined with a huge, huge deep love.
Of course. I think it's, you know, we talk a lot on the show about the grief hierarchy. And how, you know, there isn't a grief hierarchy. Grief is grief. And like, you know, just because I lost my dad, if someone lost their nan, we might feel the same kind of pain. And but I think, of course, when it comes to a life, like you said, so shortly lived, it's just unbelievably painful, isn't it? It's just terribly, terribly sad. It's just terribly sad when something is so short. Of course it is.
Yeah, and also completely understand the deep kind of sense you have of a life that won't be lived. And that feels a huge loss. It's that piece of it's not my loss, that's her loss.
Of course, yeah, that's a really lovely way of putting it. That it is about your grieving for her as much as for yourself, because you know that, you know, what she could have been and all of that. But that, yeah, it's just a terribly, terribly sad thing that some people, that humans and some humans have to go through. I just really feel for you, especially as, you know, having just had a baby, oh my God, 17 weeks ago, something like that.
No, I was cautious about having the conversation now and wondered if you wanted to leave it a bit.
But, yeah, no, and I do, because I think it's really important to talk about. And I wonder if this happened to you, actually. I think sometimes when you know someone who's lost a baby, and maybe people feel like this with dads, with me, of like, they almost don't want to mention their healthy baby because you're like, oh, that person lost a baby. And you sort of get into this world where the person who's lost a baby, no one is speaking to them about that in case they get sad.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think my situation was very different because we were very much in the public eye. So
yeah, God, that must have been so hard.
I always say the very weird upside in it was I didn't really have to explain it to anybody. I think I've having talked to many parents since who've lost babies, that it's very difficult when they re-enter their regular life and people don't know it's happened, and constantly needing to explain it when it's such sad news is a difficult thing to have to do. And that was something never had to do.
Yeah, that's true. Especially, I think, if someone is, you know, pregnancy is so visible.
Yeah, people say, oh, you've had the baby. What did you have? Yeah. How, you know, has the, you know, and all of that is very, very difficult to have to kind of keep repeating that. And I didn't have to do that. I received thousands and thousands of letters from people. And what struck me so much, I had a, you know, obviously I was able to take a bit of time off work, just go through my own grieving process. Gordon wasn't so fortunate. He had to head back into work. And maybe during that year, use that as his way of managing, where he would separate the private time that we would have That would be more about the loss and the grief we were going through, and then he would just get back into his work. But for me, I created a kind of working pattern of answering all of those letters, reading them and answering all of them. Oh. I couldn't write to everybody, but we printed a postcard, and then I was able to add notes to it. But I wrote personally to everybody who'd written to me, who expressed a similar loss themselves, who shared that loss. And what struck me overall from all of that was just how common a story it was. And when I dug a bit deeper at that time, I mean, I'm going back to 2002, I realised how common to lose a baby was as a stillbirth or in a short period of time, a neonatal death, you know, in that first month after birth, and how few explanations there were. There were some where it was obvious what had happened, and others where the obstetricians, the neonatologists working side by side would do all they could, and they knew they'd been, you know, obviously the little neonatal units with the little incubators are, that's an extraordinary thing that you're able to allow a baby to grow and flourish if it's born very early and kind of finish off the last bit outside. But so much has happened just in that little world, the little world of the incubator, where just the delicate adjustments of the oxygen levels are absolutely key to how well a baby will flourish, their brain development, their eyesight, all sorts of things. And that's moved forward in the most astonishing way. The other thing was, we're learning more just in the labs, really, about the science of what can happen, what happens through pregnancy. And so in the aftermath of that terrible loss for us, and reading and understanding how many people it affected, how many women it affected through their pregnancies, we set up the Jennifer Brown Research Laboratory, and it's based at the Queen's Medical Research Institute in Edinburgh and is part of the University of Edinburgh. And in the last 15, 16 years, it's done some absolutely remarkable work. It started off with four young women as the first cohort of scientists. And everyone said to us, look, if one or two projects kind of gain a bit of traction and come up with something, then you've done really well out of four projects. Yeah. And all four hit something. Wow. Because I think it was early days. I think it's also because they were really good at what they were doing. Mm. But it was early days for just uncovering new information, and all of them have gone off to be amazing doctors and do extraordinary things. And the work of the laboratory has flourished. It's now headed up by a young guy called Professor James Boardman, who heads the team there. And he's a neonatologist. He comes from that side. And he's now built and is running something called the Their World Edinburgh Birth Cohort, which is a cohort of babies born prematurely who, right from before they were born, all their health and their progress and how they're doing at home, at school, is tracked. So all the families are part of this study, and it will be something that will go on for decades through their lives. But it will allow those people studying it, and anybody wanting to kind of read the information that comes out of it, to understand what happens. And what we're really trying to do there is look at what you can predict, to try and do things that are preventative at the start, of course, take the actions right there in the special care baby unit, but also by understanding what happens to premature babies as they grow up to be children and further on into adulthood. What's the implications for their health? What's the implications for the way they're living their lives? Are there particular things that we'll see emerge that maybe early interventions could be more helpful for them? So that's the work that's happening now.
Is that, it's really interesting, because obviously, you know, I remember growing up and people being like, oh, they were premature, and so maybe they're slightly smaller in your class. You know, I remember being a kid and that being discussed, but I don't remember like what you're discussing there, like anything else. It was like, well, once they've, you know, once they're out of the hospital, they're just normal, that's it. So is this sort of the first time people are actually bothering to invest in the science to see actually how much it affects you?
It'll be the biggest study like it, and the one over the longest period of time. And there are, of course, other laboratories and research centres around the UK and also in other parts of the world. And more those doctors connect with each other. The doctor Ian Lang, who was the neonatologist who'd looked after Jennifer and who saw us through that time, also was there when my two other children were born and kind of checked them off, is now a trustee of of the charity, and still involved to this day. But he would host every second year what he called a perinatal festival rather than a conference or a seminar, but pulling people together, inviting them from all over the world so that they could share that information together. And I think I've learned that if everyone's doing their own amazing study, but they start to share it. And I know now that babies are being born who have a better chance of survival because of the work of all these scientists together. And I'm really proud of the contribution that our lab makes.
That's incredible. That's absolutely amazing that you went to, I mean, you know, grief drives people to make all sorts of choices,
of course,
but the fact that
it
drove you to really make a very concrete change, I think that's incredible, because it's very hard in that space of pain to, I mean, I understand like wanting to do something positive, but to really make the actions that you have done, I think is amazing, commendable that so much change has come out of that.
Yeah, I feel I went through the personal journey of grieving that loss and recognizing, I mean, certainly the impact on Gordon, but also on our wider family and friends. And those first few years are particularly tough and painful. But then there's a way where it's always part of you. There's a little piece of you that's always broken. And, you know, the pain is there. But I also, what have I learned? I learned two things, really. One is, at the beginning, because I'd always been someone who was busy and organised and running different things and active, it hadn't occurred to me what the impact would be afterwards. So my instincts were to try and put myself back together, try and be the same person I was before. Yeah. And I don't know what made the penny drop, but at some point I suddenly realised I didn't ever need to be the same person again. And it was like a weight lifted. So to put the energy into a lab, I mean, I run around and make a lot of noise about it. I raise funds for it. It connects back into their world, the charity I'm involved with, because we're doing so much international work. Because I'm mindful that our special care baby units in the UK are pretty amazing, and you'll see that in developed countries. But if you're a baby being born in sub-Saharan Africa or something, then those chances are, stacked up against you if you're an early baby. So a lot of my drive comes through that. But I also, you don't need to fix everything in the same way. And I'll talk often to parents who are going through a much more recent loss. And it's one of the things that I'll say over and over again is trying to kind of restore yourself back to being the same person. You don't have to do it. And the minute you understand you don't have to do it, everything's easier, because then you can figure it out as you go along. You don't have to keep trying to fix it.
I think that's such a sage piece of advice, because I think what happens with grief as well is that the only stable person you know is that person from the past. So I think that's why you reach for it, because you're like, well, they were stable, like their world made sense, it wasn't crazy, it wasn't scary and uncontrollable. So I know exactly what you mean, like you kind of scrabble back for that person because you're like, somewhere in the past I had my feet on the ground and now I don't. And it's a really hard acceptance of like, you never did. You never had your feet on the ground. You just thought you did because, you know, like you had an experience to great loss, or you know, things had happened that were bad, but they weren't completely without your control. And I think that's a really lovely way of putting it, that you give up the fight. You don't have to try and
There are different actions you can take. And the second overwhelming thing that I learned in that time through the kind of overwhelming pain of it was not to let go of how much love you have for the person that you've lost. Because it's very easy to go, right, I'll just manage, I'll just button myself up a bit and I'll not, because it's so sore, it's so painful. But actually letting go of that and having all the love you can is a much easier pathway, you know, through it.
I think, it's really scary to do that, I think, because like you said, you sort of have to let the river take you and just trust that you'll be okay. And I think what happens to people, like you said, is it seems so raw and so painful to trust that if you let that love out, you're going to be okay. I think it's like self-preservation, is that you think that buttoning up comes from thinking maybe I'll be safer. I'll be in less pain, but you won't. Like you said, the pain is there. And I think if you can, as you obviously have, just let the love out that you had for Jennifer. I think that's amazing. It's a real journey though, isn't it? Like you said, obviously you speak to people who are like those first few years. And I find when I do this show, if I speak to people, I call them like fresh grievers. Like it's a very different, they're looking at very different worlds. If they're, you know, and obviously for me, I'm talking about not babies or children, but if they've just lost their parent or someone, you know, in their family who's very close and they're say 1, 2, 3 years into it. And they sometimes, I don't know if you have this, sometimes they talk to me and I'm 20 something years down the line and they give me a look like, oh my God, am I still going to feel like this in 20 years time? And you want to be like, it's not that you won't be okay, you will be. But of course, like you said, it's always part of you. And it's, I guess it's hard to see that at the beginning of the journey.
No, at the beginning of the journey, it's you're taking each day and some days you're just absolutely floored by it and can't do anything. And then other days, which are an easier day, you get to the end of it and actually feel guilty that you managed your way through the day.
Yes.
So it's really complicated that first time through it. Gordon was interesting because the thing, he loves music and will listen to a lot of music, and he couldn't listen to music at all.
Oh, it's too much.
For a good year plus, I would say.
Yeah.
And even then went back into it quite gently because music just goes straight at you and unlocks emotion. Mm. And that was too, it was like too raw and too much. Mm. And it took a while to kind of move back round to that.
And I think that's so important for people to realise that if you say you can't listen to music, it's not that you never will be, but like you might just have to wait.
Might,
like you said, when it's so raw and it's so painful, it sometimes your body's protecting you. Your body's just like, no, you're not ready.
Yeah.
You're not ready to open that box yet, but you will be. And it's really trusting yourself, isn't it? Of like, okay, not yet, but not, because it would have been easy for him to think, well, I'm never going to listen to music ever again.
Well, you don't know. You don't know how long it will last. Yeah. You don't know what that is. It just, that's what it was at that time.
At that time,
and then a couple of years further down the line, I could hear music coming out of his study and I think, oh, okay. You know, that's moved on a bit.
That must have been so nice to hear that and feel like, okay, he's able to hear that again. That must have been really moving.
Yeah, and I think he missed music, but you just do what you can and protect yourself. But it's that balancing thing of not locking yourself down too much. You've got to do the work and you've got to let yourself go through things that are really painful.
Yeah, you're right. It's such a balance. I think that's such a key word of like being kind, but not locking it away.
Yeah.
being like, okay, today I can't handle it, but keep checking in because there might be a day you can handle it, rather than going, that's it, door's closed, I'm never going to talk about it, I'm never going to listen to music, it's too painful. Because you often can get there, but you have to sort of keep asking yourself the question, I suppose, of like, are you ready to have that chat?
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. Did you seek counselling or anything like that, or was it just too...
Well, I talked to quite a lot of people, but I didn't actually have a therapist myself, but I certainly went and talked to people who were experts, talked to people who'd experienced that before, and used the opportunity of parents who'd lost children earlier. And then I kind of pay that forward by being available for those conversations now.
I think that's such an important part of the sort of grief network that perhaps isn't talked about a lot, that if somebody is kind to you who's been in that situation,
yeah,
you appreciate it so much, don't you? Especially when they've had a similar situation to you. And then, yeah, paying it forward of being like, right, now whenever I hear somebody in that situation, I will text them and say, what do you need? I'm here. I can help you.
Yeah, very much so. And I remember the letters that I'd read at the beginning of women who'd written to me saying, I lost a baby 50 years ago. And and of course, at that time, no one talked about it. You sort of were supposed to get over it, have another one, move on. What I learned very quickly from that group of women writing to me was something that's quite important now for me with my children. I have two teenagers now, and each child is so different. Jennifer is so different to my other two. And because you get to know that little person and who they are, so they feel very separate and very individual from each other. And lots of times people come at you from the outside with a sort of, oh, if you have another one, it'll make it better. And that's a very out of date way of thinking. But it also means you invest everything, you know, in there. It's just, you know, everyone's different and everyone you love in your life is different and separate.
It's a really strange thing that seems to happen with child and baby grief particularly, because, you know, no one in my life has said to me, why don't you just get a new dad? Like, no one's ever gone, oh, you know, let's just have another one, find another dad. It's like, they might say, oh, it's nice to have a male, different male role model or something, but you wouldn't say that to someone whose grandma died.
No, sure.
And yet, but for children, it's like this idea, like you said, that because you didn't know them, inverted commas, they weren't, their personality wasn't completely fully formed, therefore you won't, you know, miss them, or you can just have another one, and it's the same as if it's a cat.
But we,
I think even people with cats would disagree that.
Yeah, we know and understand a lot more, I think. I think ideas have really shaped and evolved, and, you know, I know that what I was looking at and the experience that happened to us is just very different now. I mean, it's still too high, the rates of stillbirths and neonatal deaths, and there's still so many things to explore and understand, but the breakthroughs have been extraordinary. One thing that brought it round full circle for us is Gordon was obviously leader of the Labour Party, but prior to, you know, and before Tony Blair, John Smith had been the leader of the Labour Party, who had died very suddenly, and his three daughters lost their dad far too young. But Catherine, who's a lawyer, had married another lawyer. She has a little girl who was born very, very prematurely and had a very precarious start in life. And Ella is now at nursery school and will be starting big school very soon and has thrived. But when Catherine was in hospital being looked after, they told her that what had saved her daughter's life was the work of our lab.
Oh, Sarah, that's incredible.
And everyone always says to you, if you save one life, it's enough.
Oh my God, yeah. you don't need to rack it up into the hundreds. I think one is more than enough. That's incredible.
But it just comes, full circle, how it all connects, you know.
It's very strange, isn't it? It's very strange, I think, once you're willing to see that side of life, that there is death and there is pain and there is that, you know, very unspoken place present. Like you said, it is common. And once you're willing to accept that and you can see how much it can be connected to life in the same way.
For sure.
It doesn't always necessarily lead for a less painful life, but it's a more truthful life, I think, once you sort of are aware of that side of it. But that's incredible that Jennifer has led to that.
Yeah, and I know that the work's also led to a lot of changes in lots of other areas, but it was just the kind of poignancy of it coming back round into our own world.
Yeah. Is that, like you said, to someone being able, who you knew, being able to say that back to you?
Yeah, exactly.
So you have two sons now. I wonder if you mind me asking, if when you were pregnant with, I guess, with John, was that very difficult? Did you have a lot of anxiety about it, or were you in the midst of speaking to obstetric, you know, because of the trust, were you much more able to sort of deal with that side of it?
Well, I was checked and looked after all the way through it, and there was never anything to worry about during the whole of it. So of course I was cautious and aware of it, but probably as much as anyone else who'd felt a reason to be kind of you know, anxious if somebody had had miscarriages before or something. You know, you'd always be cautious going through it. So I was really careful and I was looked after and checked probably more than I would have been otherwise. And everything went very smoothly with both of them. So, but it's, you know, every day and month and, you know, of the pregnancy felt very long, you know.
Yeah,
time stands still at the end, doesn't it, anyway? So.
Yeah, God, and I can imagine. I can imagine it's... But you worry, obviously, as I've just been through, you worry anyway with
pregnancy. Yeah, of course you do, yeah.
You know, and like you said, but yeah, once you've been through something like that.
So I don't know whether I worried more or I just did the right amount of worry.
all the way through. Tell,
and I'm always mindful thinking of them that they grow up with a big sister they never got to know. And that has an impact in your family too. So we've always...
How have you talked to them about it?
Talked openly, her pictures in our house with theirs. And I've always, you know, explained to them that, you know, the shortness of her life meant that we just had a big focus, you know, with her and all the time that we spent with her. But you don't get to decide those things somehow. You know, there's the huge unfairness of it. But
yeah, I think it's good if you can. I think it's really good if you can talk about it with other children. Obviously, I don't have the experience, but I, from my other experience of grief, that I think it's easy for children to become scared of these things if it's not discussed.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, for some people, it's just too hard to even say out loud. I do understand that. So the fact that they are very aware. But then I guess, as you said, you know, you were so in the public eye, like... But you think that was a positive in a way because you said...
Well,
you didn't
it wasn't really because we were under such scrutiny. It was awful. Mm. I mean, in so many ways, it was so painful. But it was just I never had to explain my situation to anyone. I mean, literally to anyone.
Yeah, because I was just I remember it being in the papers.
Mm.
And that's just thinking like... It's such a different world when your life is headlines. I can't imagine how difficult that must have been when you're trying to deal with something that's sort of unfathomable anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I can go about my life now without anyone paying any attention at all. And but then at that particular moment and for a long time afterwards, yeah. So everywhere I would go, people would come up and talk. People were sweet about it. Most people will say most of the time the right thing, and every now and then someone will say something so cluckingly awful that you can't quite believe they've said it, and you also sometimes catch their eye and realise they can't believe they've said it either.
Yes.
But it's just what I learned then was everybody is well-meaning, even when they say the wrong thing. There's nobody that's trying to say to you, it doesn't matter or it's not important, or they're all saying whatever's coming out of their mouth, they're all saying, I'm so sorry, that's absolutely terrible, I'm so sorry that happened to you.
I think that's a really good thing to remember, because I think when you are quite raw it just feels like knives.
Stupid thing. And if I was standing with a friend or something, they'd be going, I cannot believe that person just said that. I mean, one of the charities that look after that deal with baby deaths and used it, I thought, but unfortunately, as an opportunity to kind of promote themselves. But we were at a big conference or something, a Labour Party conference or something like that, probably. There was lots of people, and I remember this man chasing me down the corridor to try and have a conversation with me about it. And I know what he was doing was thinking, we're all in this together, and there's, I don't know, but it was 100% the wrong thing to be doing. And he got seen off the people that I was with so sharply. But
you're
it was
being very
quite
gracious,
jaw-dropping,
Sarah.
Where you go, I know, but you kind of go, there must have been a thought process that went, oh, I'll just go and have that conversation and maybe that will help this charity. But it was just like, that was so, it was the wrong judgment. So appallingly, really.
You're being very kind about what is a very silly thing to do.
It was just really
but I
awful.
Think so,
but yeah,
I know what you mean, because I have it as well. Like, you know, I think, and also I found the longer the grief has gone on, I've got much more empathetic with people. Whereas when I was, you know, a fresher, I'd be like, whoa, like, what the f you just said to me?
Yeah.
Whereas now I think I can see, you could, like you said, you can see in their eyes, like, they're trying so hard,
yeah.
And
if they don't have the experience, they don't, you know, you can kind of go to all the wrong places and say, Yeah, the wrong thing. And when it's something, you know, where, you know, you lost your dad really over such a short period of time, that whole shock to the system and kind of processing it, people walk right into that one, you know, and say ludicrous things, you know.
Oh, God, definitely. And I think it's just, it took me a long time to realise of like, it's hard, because I think when you've had it happen to you for quite a long while, you're on like the fence of grief. So you can't see what it's like from the other side. You're like, why can't you just think of something pleasant to say? But when you are on the other side, as I have been, it took a long time for me to be on that side, that I remember being faced with someone and thinking, oh my God, I don't know what to say. This is hard.
Yeah.
Whereas I think when you're just consumed with your own pain, you just think like, it's to you, you're like, oh, that's difficult, is it? You don't know what to say. Well, actually, what I'm feeling is extremely difficult. But yeah, I think it's a really complicated thing, isn't it, when it happens to someone in the public eye. And I have this with asking people to do the show, because, you know, I might read about someone who's had a great, and think, oh, I wonder if they'd like to do the show. And then I have to check myself and be like, Carrie, they might not want to talk about it. Because especially when it's, you know, like you said, it's early days, it can be so painful. So chasing someone down a corridor is never a good idea.
It's not the least a good they could move,
do
really.
It's no. Contacted your people, you know what
it's
I mean?
Something,
like, I think, did you ever feel like, and you don't have to answer this at all, but I just wonder, because of the world you were in, particularly, I guess, I think it's fair to say politics is a fairly masculine world. Did you ever feel like there was a lack of feeling that world you were living, because you were living at, I was going to say 10, it's number 11, isn't it? Or what? You were in Downing Street, that's my
point. Yeah, we were in Downing Street. Yeah, it's really complicated, because there's at that time we would have been at number 11, but the accommodation is at number 10 and vice versa. So it's a complete muddle for anyone to figure out.
Oh my goodness. But yeah, did you feel like that Westminster particularly was struggled to...
A kind of harsh environment to go through
that. Yeah, yeah.
No, but only because I think, you know, even politicians and civil servants are human.
Yes, too. Yeah.
And having, you know, a lot of them are part of my world, and people were extraordinarily kind, you know, and reached out cross-party and, you know, engaged. And I think people were very sympathetic and thoughtful working around Gordon while recognising the fact that he was getting on with a job. Yeah, so no, I didn't find that was a difficult environment. Slightly more differently, when it comes to the policy end, I don't think quite so much happens. And I think that kind of quite heavily male-dominated environment misses things, I think, are kind of, you know, and that's true in lots of other ways, you know, a sort of dominant white environment misses things across other communities. So there's when we were at number 10 and Gordon was Prime Minister, one of the things I picked up on was the international focus for women through pregnancy and the high rates of maternal mortality around the world. So that became a very big campaign for me during the 3 years there. And the thing that triggered that was there was something at that time called the Millennium Development Goals, and there were 8 goals, and each one of them had targets to reduce poverty and ensure child survival and impact on climate change. And one of them, number 5, right in the middle, was to reduce the number of maternal deaths around the world. And that was the one that had made zero progress. Nothing had happened. The numbers hadn't shifted. And this, we're in 2007 now, 2008. And so I asked for the papers from the G8 meetings to say what had been discussed, because there was always a moment where they were down to discuss those 8 goals. And it turned out that at the G8 meetings, they'd never discussed that goal. They'd never discussed maternal mortality. They'd skipped over it. So I pushed back and went...
We don't need to.
When it gets worse, I'm afraid. I pushed back, asked a really helpful civil servant and said, please, could you... You know, you're the Sherpa for these G8 meetings. Could you tell me... Could you find out why they've not discussed it? And here comes the answer. No one had anything to say. That was the reason they had never discussed it.
Oh, fucking hell.
So I joined up with the White Ribbon Alliance and various different media parts. Anyway, we coordinated a campaign that by the time it moved to the, you know, 3 G8s later, and we were gone by then, but there was a massive outpouring of money. And I felt that, but it was just one of those ones where you just scratch the surface and suddenly there was a lot to say and a lot that could be done. And it was just about unlocking the political will and the funding for it. And guess what? It made a difference. And
It's incredible, isn't it, sometimes, how fresh these things are.
I don't think I'd have known to ask, nor been as bold about it. But I think that's the time when government can get stuck with things. If you need that, you need all kinds of people in government. It's, you know, we need more different, you know, kind of whole range of people contributing, because otherwise we're missing things that are important to people. It can't just all be one kind of person.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it as you know, as the, you know, Black Lives Matter movement has been educating us all on so eloquently recently, of like, you just go, there's so many things that, of course, if it doesn't cross your path right in front of you, it's hard to notice it. And it's, I feel like that a lot with grief. You know, when I speak to people who haven't experienced it, those, they just have never had to think about it because they haven't.
Yeah, so we, you know, life from our own experiences, people get stuff wrong and are a bit scratchy about it. But also when you first start asking the questions and making the demands, you're going to get pushback and it's tricky. So if there ever's a lesson from any of the things I've done, I would say to the Black Lives Matter people, don't give up, because once you get going and once people are listening, unlocking the political will and the financing is a huge amount of what will make a lasting difference, you know.
Yeah, God, yeah, yeah. And for people to be aware that, like you said, with the maternal death rates, of like, there is something to say about that. There's never nothing to say. Like, there is something to always, as you said, once you scratch the surface.
God, yeah, and we have a National Health Service here. So actually, when you look across different groups, it's clearly families who are less well off who will have higher rates. So we have to do more there. But if you go to a country like the USA, where it's all private healthcare, it's Black families who are more adversely affected by it, whether maternal death rates are higher, whether infant death rates are higher. And in some parts of the states, for the same reasons as some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, the same levels. And it's the same reason, which is lack of access to affordable, decent quality healthcare.
Well, it's the same here, isn't it? I know that Black women in the UK are 5 times more likely to die in childbirth than their white counterparts, which, you know, is just incredibly shocking, isn't it? Well, it isn't shocking. It is shocking and it isn't shocking, because it's the facts and it's the truth. But yeah, it still makes you sort of step back and look at the word 2020, doesn't it? Sometimes, like, you know, as you said, there have been huge leaps and that's amazing. But there's work to do.
Yeah.
With Jennifer's memory, obviously you have... You know, you've done all this work and you have the trust. Do you have anything sort of more, I guess this is a very personal question.
More personal.
Is there like the anniversary and stuff for you? Is it?
Yeah. So for us, the anniversary of her birth is really important to us. So falling just after Christmas. So when we are in the holiday time, we tend to go very quiet and be together as a family. Jennifer's buried in a small churchyard that's about 25 miles away from where we live, which I do remember when we first decided that she would be there, feeling that at least it was just far enough away that I wouldn't kind of completely just be there all the time. It was quite healthy for me.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it was it's a good, I don't know, it's maybe a little bit further than that, but it's like a good, I don't know, half an hour, 40 minutes drive to get to. So it's just far enough away that you can't just kind of pop in there. But that's quite an important place for us to go. The reason why we chose there, because we were in Fife in Scotland, it's where Jennifer was born, and then she'd passed away in Edinburgh in the Royal Infirmary there, that Gordon's family, my family have a big connection with Fife, but Gordon's father and his mother are buried in that same churchyard, and we were able to get that space. So it was a decision we could make that was near to us and had a family connection and you know, felt and so safe and secure, you know.
Yeah, of course. And do you go every year? Is that sort of your
always go there then. We'll go other times of the year. And that was where difficult in lockdown actually was feeling you couldn't go. And I thought of families who you just think that kind of ritual of being able to go is to somewhere. It was, I think, would have been quite a tricky one through lockdown for a lot of people.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot, obviously in different circumstances, because I think you can only, you know, you're shaped by your own experience. And I've been thinking about if you know, losing someone in lockdown, I think once you've been through something very traumatic, lockdown is that extra trauma, isn't it? And I've been really thinking, God, if you had to deal with a cancer situation right now, when you know,
it's really tough,
it's really tough, isn't it? And I think, like you said, it's as ever, it's because you've been through it, you can imagine, you know how hard it was without that.
Yeah.
So imagining having to deal with, you know, palliative care nurses in full PPE and not being able to see your friends and family before someone goes, it's just, so yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. Of course, he wasn't buried, we sort of scattered his ashes. So I hadn't thought of, like, yeah, having a place that is really important to you that allows you to connect with them, and then not being allowed to go there must have been really painful.
Well, you just sort of felt you've got to follow the guidelines and can't, you know, no kind of special trips just because you decide it's important for you. So we all follow the rule. Most of us followed the rules anyway.
Most of us did. Most of us thought that was important to do.
But we've been able to go more recently, and that's felt really good to be able to go and leave some flowers and, you know, just be there. But I also feel she's very much around us, so...
Yeah, and it sounds like she really is, you know, like she's, you know, with the work of the trust and the work that you've done to help other people, and just, I think, gaining the understanding that you have of what happened.
Yeah, you can't unknow it, and then you think you have to do something.
I read a thing, I don't know if this will be helpful, but when I first started doing this show, and I was Googling grief or something, and I found this like site, which was like reactions to grief. And I was like, oh, okay. And it had all these like four categories of like how people react. And the last one was activist.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, this person is driven by their grief to do everything possible to help and change because, you know, they are so confounded with what they wasn't there for them. And I remember reading it and being like, ugh. Like, you know, when there's like a mirror, you're like, oh God, I thought I was just doing something really normal. And I think it sort of sat with me for a bit, and I was like, oh, am I doing it wrong? And then I was like, actually, Why not? Like you said, why not become an activist after something has happened to you that was difficult and there wasn't quite the things that you needed to know? So I think, yeah, it sounds like you have.
Well, I haven't changed gear in that regard. I mean, I'd been activist is such a cheesy word, really, in lots of ways.
I know. But it is now. I remember I read it quite a few years ago when it wasn't such a term thrown around. Yeah.
But I suppose everything I did before was geared around what the things were you could do to change things going, you know. Back a long way to the old Drop the Deck campaigns and the, you know, anti-Nazi League stuff and stuff. So I'm, you know, so ancient. I was part of all of that anti-apartheid. And so I guess I'm just harnessing that. You feel that you should do the things that you could do. And I'll pull in, you know, other people I know who've got different skills and can bring in different things that they bring to it. But I don't feel as though I've changed gear with my life to accommodate so much that's kind of for and about Jennifer. Although talking to you today, I realize it sounds like quite a lot, but it doesn't feel like it's kind of an overwhelming part of my life. It's just something that sort of chunters along at the side,
and it doesn't, I know what you mean, like, you know, I don't feel like this podcast like dominates my life.
It's not anything. Yeah.
Yeah, no, not at all. And of course when you talk about it and then people think, oh, she does talk about death, and you're like, no, I do also watch RuPaul's Drag Race and like have other chats. But like, this is obviously what we're talking about. But I just think it's, you know, death exists, you can't do anything about it. That's the facts. That's the really horrible, hard facts that you have to learn. If something positive can come out of it, obviously it doesn't for everybody, but if you can find some way of carrying it with you and allowing something positive to be there at the same time as the pain, I do think it's not a bad thing. And it sounds like that's what's happened with Jennifer, that all this amazing work and all this knowledge and education that you've been able to share, I just think that's
fight the idea that we lost her far too young and she lost her you know, the rest of her life, that's the bit that's infuriating and unfair. But if I focus on the time that we did have, it was incredibly precious and I can remember all of it, and also the lessons learnt from it you can kind of put to good effect, and she feels a part of that.
I think that's a really important thing to end on as well, that it's not that there's no positive to what happened to her, you know, like you said, like it was too precious, it was too short, and that is deeply painful. And I feel like that, you know, when I talk about my dad as well, like, you know, he was really young and I was really young, and it's really sad, but it doesn't mean that life is just so much more complicated than that. I think sometimes when people hear like, oh, well, I still carry that grief, they imagine, oh, would you just spend your days wailing and not being happy? And you're like, no, it's more colourful than that. Like you said, this isn't just the one thing you do. This is an aspect of that you do, and you carry Jennifer with you. but it's not the whole of what has happened to you since that.
No, and my life with my family is kind of, there's so many other aspects to it for all of us. So, yeah. Life is there to live for sure. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me about Jennifer. I really, really appreciate it. And I just think what you've done sounds amazing. So thank you for all that as well. And we will provide information for about their world and the trust as well, if people want to see it on the show notes.
Thank you.
You can follow Sarah on Twitter at SarahBrownUK, and you can follow her global children's charity Their World at Their World as T-H-E-I-R World. For more information, please visit www.theirworld.org. And for more information on the Jennifer Brown Research Laboratory, if you head to the Their World website and go to projects, Jennifer Brown Research Laboratory, there's more information there. And they also have the story of Catherine Smith and Ella on there as well, which is the little girl whose life was saved thanks to the research that Sarah had done. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. I hope that the episode is useful or helpful in some way. If you are going through baby loss or have gone through it, as I said, there are other episodes, and the charity Saying Goodbye is the one that I do really recommend. Zoe, who runs it, Zoe Clark Coates, is on Instagram as well and posts a lot of wonderful stuff. You've been listening to The Griefcast. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland. It was recorded in my living room and Sarah's study, I think. And the music was provided by the Glue Ensemble. And artwork is by Jade Perkin. And remember, you are not alone.